Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 926. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Tor Books, the proud publisher of Shroud of Eternity by Terry Goodkind. Shroud of Eternity picks up where Terry Goodkind's New York Times bestseller Death's Mistress left off, promising a thrilling brew of bloodshed, deception, sorcery. The formidable sorceress Nikki and her companions, the newly powerless Nathan and the youthful Bannon, set out for another quest after driving ruthless slavers out of Renda Bay. Their mission? Restore Nathan's magic. And for Nikki, save the world. So please, don't miss Shroud of Eternity by Terry Goodkind. It's available now wherever books are sold. Let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard to find out where there's some stuff going on. First of all, I'm going to be performing in Phoenix, Arizona on Thursday through Saturday, February 8th through 10th at Stand Up Live, then the following week at the Brea Improv in Brea, California, and then the following week, February 23rd, 24th, in Oxnard, California at Levity Live. So tickets are on the internet for that. Please come out. I think I'm going to bring Mike Furman and April Richardson, and we'll have a nice time. Also, from the community, the Laguna Art Museum in Laguna Beach will be kicking off a year-long series of centennial celebrations with their Centennial Bash. On January 27th, it'll bring hundreds of art lovers and enthusiasts together and feature installations by artists Megan Geckler, Elizabeth Turk, and Friends With You. Live music by Matt Costa, DJ Nina Tarr, craft beer tasting by Laguna Beach Beer Company, and food by Las Brisas. Presale tickets are on sale now. They're offering Nerdist listeners a discount to get tickets for $20 by entering the code ARTNERD. All one word. Visit LagunaArtMuseum.org for tickets and info. Also, Todd Glass has been leaving comedian Blake Wexler voicemails for the past 12 years. They're releasing all of them as a comedy album this Friday, January 12th. What started as a young comic saving hilarious voicemails from his comedy hero Todd Glass quickly morphed into a combination of bits and joke-em-ups and a documentation of a decade-plus evolution of a friendship. He describes it as hoop dreams for comedy nerds. So 12 years of voicemails from Todd Glass to Blake Wexler is now available for pre-order on iTunes. It releases Friday, January 12th of 2018, which is this year. This episode is Paul Thomas Anderson, who is, I mean, is it kind of an understatement to say he is an incredible director? He is a genius. He is promoting Phantom Thread, which is playing in select theaters now. It is, I believe, Daniel Day-Lewis's last movie before he has decided to not be an actor anymore. So you should definitely see it. The performances in this movie and the direction and the music and everything, it's such a beautiful movie. It'll be playing everywhere January 19th, so go see it. Paul Thomas Anderson, support good artists. This episode also brought to you by Stamps.com, who has been an amazing sponsor for the Nerdist Podcast for all these years. So here's a New Year's resolution you can actually keep. Stamps.com, you can add to your business, save a ton of time and money this year. Bring all the services of the Postal Service right to your computer. You create Stamps.com account in minutes. You can print official U.S. postage right to your computer printer. That's it. Any letter, package, class of mail, then the mail carrier picks it up. No leaving the office, no hassle. And they're going to send you a digital scale that automatically calculates postage, the exact postage you need, and it is a fraction of the cost of the expensive postage meter. So right now, enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Are you ready for a happier new year? Go to Stamps.com. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist at the top of the homepage. And now, here's Nerdist Podcast number 926 with Paul Thomas Anderson, Katie
Please roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Amazing hotel, and it was owned for a long time. I think still is by, oh God, a church group, and everybody always wanted to shoot there, but the church group wouldn't let them, or they would want script approval or something like that.
Oh jeez.
So it really limited the opportunities.
I want to know what movies they allowed though with the script approval.
So in Inherent Vice, can you just say the Church of the Burning Sun is the only true religion? No, I don't think we're going to be able
to. It's just the title, Vice. It brings up a bad thing. What about?
We saw Phantom Thread last night. We went and saw a screening of it. It was fucking great.
Yeah, it's great. Great job, man.
Oh my God. You know, it just, I guess, you know, most of the time, you know, not all movies are great, but then when you see a great movie with amazing performances, you're like, oh, this is what they're supposed to be like. Oh, this is what that's supposed to look like. But Daniel Day-Lewis is just.
Everybody really nails it.
It really is. I mean, we'll talk about it some. I just don't want to give anything away.
Yeah.
So
I did feel like I could be a better husband after watching the movie.
I saw so many things. Where I'm like, oh yeah, I do that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, do that too. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's very familiar. Yeah.
I'm reading.
That's
something.
Good. Right.
that's so many flashes of just times I've, you know, just been a dick, and it's yeah. It was a real good movie.
Well, at first you sort of, you know, you feel empathetic where you're like, he's just trying to focus on work. What is wrong with that? And then you just see the recurring patterns. You're like,
oh yeah, that's, yeah.
What's the, and this isn't really giving anything away, but the tea scene when she brings in tea and he didn't ask for tea.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, I'm taking it out. He's like, but it doesn't change the fact that you.
The interruption is staying right here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like, that's a classic example of what it's like to work with Daniel. Like, I didn't mean it like that. What I meant was, I wrote that scene, and I think maybe the ending I had was something, maybe I didn't even have one. It was like, I don't want tea, take it out. I don't want tea, take it out. And Daniel comes up with the best line of the thing, which is, well, the tea is going out, but the interruption is staying right here with me. That's the kind of thing you get when you get Daniel Day-Lewis.
He's like, incredible.
Right? He comes up with the bits that everybody will remember.
I mean, how do you even characterize him? Because he is a character actor. He is a character actor, but he's also an actor. He's a leading actor, but he's kind of a weird hybrid.
Yeah, he's one of a kind. He's Daniel Day-Lewis. As you know, there's a reason he's Daniel Day-Lewis, because he's Daniel Day-Lewis.
That's right.
But his performances, yeah, usually the things that maybe we're thinking about, like Bill the Butcher, you know, or Lincoln, they're larger than life creations, you know. Very rarely do you see him like an equally great actor, Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks kind of has a certain kind of personality that he can play variations on. Once in a while, he'll do something like different, like Sully or something like that. But Daniel genuinely seems to sort of shapeshift into something else, but I guess we feel this need to categorize it. If it's a kind of a performance, it's a character. You say, well, he's a character actor, but he's front and center, and he's the most interesting thing in anything he does. So
I guess I guess it's because he also he makes them so unique that they sort of become characters. Whereas if someone else had played Woodcock, it probably wouldn't have had all the nuance. I mean, it's like it when you see someone who's so effortless that it's just like, I'm watching this guy.
Yeah, I know. No, and I've said something to that effect, and it kind of sounds almost inarticulate. You're trying to describe it. And I remember showing a guy I work with a lot when he saw him put his socks on, And he's like, I don't know how to describe it, except I just watched a man put his socks on. You know, and I think it's some feeling that you feel somebody inhabiting something and some kind of strange magic with Daniel that you – I don't know how it works. I've worked with him twice, and I still don't know how it works. It's just – it's and it's like that live in front of you, you know. I sat there in the front row and watched it happen, and it's the same. It's the same feeling that you get. When you watch the film, you're like, there's a guy shaving. I've never really watched a man shave like that before. It's strange. I don't know how he does it, but I like it.
I remember when I was in college, my best friend from high school had skipped college and became a storyboard artist. And I was a kind of an amateur cartoonist. And I go, hey, maybe I want to try getting the storyboard artist. And he goes, okay, draw a guy walking across the street. I was like, well, that's not hard. And I never made one line on the page because I – because then when I started to think about like, oh, well, what kind of guy? What street? What's he doing? I don't know. Like, I just couldn't – like so much of my conscious mind was in the way rather than just doing it. And I think it's kind of the same thing when you watch someone – because those would be two different parts of your brain when you're pretending and when you're being. And when you're watching him, you're like, he's just is. He just is that thing.
Yeah. I remember him when we were talking about other actors – it's kind of a window into how an actor might look at other actors and appreciate their performances in that way that you just said. He was talking about, I don't remember the film, but we had just seen it and we were on the phone, and he was talking about John C. Reilly, who had in a scene woke up, I think, and answered the phone. He said, do you remember that scene when he wakes up and he answers the phone? I said, yeah. He says, fucking Reilly. Looks like he just woke up. You know? And it was like, and that's what you're talking about. That's what you want. It's like, yeah, you look like, if you're going to look like you just woke up, you look like you just woke up.
Did you tell John that?
I don't remember. Probably. I thought I told him that.
Yeah. There was the guy who played the doctor in the movie had a John C. Reilly vibe to him. Or maybe it was just the forehead.
Is that Irish Irish mug.
I guess so.
Yeah.
When he popped up, I was like, I wonder if he's a Reilly.
Yeah.
Some other – is this like the new Baldwins? Is this going to be a bunch of C. Reillys everywhere?
Probably in a certain – some village from – because that actor's Irish, Brian Gleeson. His brother's Domhnall Gleeson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's Brendan Gleeson's son.
Exactly right.
He's got that Irish little bit of a lisp there, doesn't he?
I don't know what if that's a regional Irish, but there is sort of the like the Cranberries Irish.
The Cranberries Irish.
Which is like the Queen's English, the Cranberries Irish.
Yeah.
But then there's that lispy version too, and I don't know where that's from. Is that regional or is that just...
I don't know Irish accents. I don't have an ear for that at all. It all sounds Irish to me.
It's very offensive.
I know that there's a very particular Dublin accent. Dubliners have a particular accent.
It's probably not as offensive to me going, they talk like this with a little bit of a lisp.
They sound like leprechauns.
Yeah, they do. Yes. Oh. Yeah. I'm not going to launch into that because I feel like someone's going to be like, that's not cool anymore.
You can't do it.
You're not allowed to do that anymore.
I don't know. I think the Irish would probably be, they're always, they're happy to be laughing at themselves.
Good. So they'd be charmed by the clumsiness of what I'm doing.
Absolutely.
They'd be drunk. See, that's a
come on.
That's the part that shouldn't have happened.
That's not cool you.
I'm using myself as an example.
As he drinks boxed water.
Yeah.
The boxed water, by the way, we're giving it a shot to maybe not use so much plastic, but it's just this weird thing where you got to turn it like shotgun style.
It's like this.
Yeah, I just feel like it's strange.
You haven't turned it at all.
Are you okay with the box water, Paul?
The upper portion is scratching.
It's mushing into
part
your
of
face.
My lip. Yeah.
But yeah.
Other than that, it tastes good.
Yeah, I know. Maybe we should just go. I think we should go back to plastics. I want to talk a little bit also about your history with Largo. That was when I started doing stand up. It was kind of at Largo. And the Monday night comedy shows at Largo, I mean, even as much as, you know, the Cornette Largo era is superlative, you know, that old club on Fairfax, which there's still a restaurant there now, that community restaurant, and they retained, like, they kept, if you go in the bathrooms, they kept, like, the Largo signs.
That's right.
They made it the ceiling, and the stage is still there. But when did you stumble upon that, and how did you get involved in that scene?
it would be through John Bryan, who I met through Michael Penn, who I called up to score my first film.
Right.
And when I so when I called Michael Penn, he said, I would love to do this, but I'd like to do it with a guy named John Bryan. I said, okay. I was kind of calling you, but who's John Bryan? And
now, first film, real quick, is this Heart and Cigarettes or
Heartache? Heartache.
Okay,
that was Heartache.
And so when I met John Bryan, I was in love instantly. Such a lunatic and a genius and brilliant. And then he was. I think he was about, I mean, he knew Flanagan, obviously, and he, I don't remember what shape Largo was at that time, but somewhere then between meeting John Bryan and somehow 6 to 8 months later, I found myself part of this group of people on Fairfax, generally on Friday nights, but Amy Mann was a big part of that as well, because she's married to Michael, and she would perform there regularly, and then... Getting to know Flanagan just meant like, right, I'm going to be here more than just to see John Bryan. I'm going to be here to see Flanagan and to see whatever else he tells me I should come and see. Hmm. So many great things that came through there. Do you remember White Trash Wins a Lotto?
Of course I do. Yes. Yeah. That was, I mean, I remember, I think maybe the first year I ever did Aspen, when that was still a thing, I think White Trash was there that year.
Is that right?
And that was. Did you ever see White Trash Wins Lotto?
No. I think it was done by the time I moved out here.
Oh, because
it was like late '90s, right?
When
it was still going on.
Yeah, kind of late '90s.
The first time I tried to go to Largo was 2001, and I waited in line to see Tenacious D, and I was the last person. Like the person in front of me was the last person to get in, and then they closed the door. And it was fine though, because I was hoping I didn't have a fake ID. I was hoping to talk my way in.
Sounds like White Trash Lost Lotto.
Good point.
Did you have anything to do with it, or did you? Were you just a fan of it?
No, it just rattled my memory bank, and it came to my mind. It was amazing though. I saw it at least 5 or 6 times.
What was the show? It was like a play.
It's kind of a it was like a musical that sort of made fun of Axl Rose.
Yeah, it was a like kind of overscaled Broadway style musical that told the story of Axl Rose with like a stalk of corn or the wheat grain in his mouth stepping off a bus and hitting the big lights of Hollywood and what happened from there. He just kind of made into this the music was great, the stories were great, and just deeply funny at the construction of a band and becoming rock stars and drug addicts and lunatics and all that. And it was pretty great.
Was it a guy from Wall of Voodoo? Was it
Andy Preboy.
Yeah.
Preboy? That's right.
Preboy,
I think.
Yeah, I think it was.
And who was the replacement singer in Wall of Voodoo. That's right. After Stan Ridgeway.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have my facts.
Stan Ridgeway used to be a customer of the record store I worked at.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there were so many shows that like kind of really popped at Largo, like Naked Trucker.
Yeah,
and, that's right. Naked Trucker, right.
Naked Trucker was great.
Mary Lynn Rice Cup and Karen Kilgariff.
Girls Guitar Club.
Guitar Club. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was great.
That was great too. And then I saw at the
Higgins Boy.
The Higgins Boys and Group predates Largo by like a decade.
All right.
Yeah, I saw Mitch Hedberg once at Largo read what he called I wrote a menu on spec, and then he just read menu that he wrote, and then he would stop, he was basically just like food items, and then he'd be like, I'm not sure I am using braised correctly in that context, and he just fucking read a menu that he wrote. I mean, it was such a great fertile ground for experimentation, but then also, I mean, you can sort of see the parallels of that kind of artistic comedy scene and then the film movement that I think you helped create, like in the early mid 90s, and it, you know, it was such an incredible magnet. I mean, do you sort of look at that and say like, oh, we all sort of fed each other. Like we were all kind of helpful to each other in those ways.
Well, I certainly felt inspired by my nights there and not even directly like, oh, I'm seeing a performer like Mary Lynn or Patton Oswalt and they can come play a part in this film, because certainly there was that. But I suppose you're right, and I never really thought of that, where I haven't in a long time, of just like feeling good after going out to a night there and getting energized to wake up the next morning and start, you know, and keep writing, working whatever you're working on. There was a really, it was a really fertile time. And certainly Amy's music, that she was playing there a lot, was inspiring me to write Magnolia.
Yep.
At the time. So then that would be the film that probably at that time came out of my experiences spending time there.
That's really rad.
Amy's, you know, it's, because I, when she did the soundtrack for Magnolia, I hadn't really heard anything much of hers, because that was slightly, it was a little bit maybe before I came into Largo. It was like 98 was when I came in, but I hadn't really heard much of her since Till Tuesday, which to me was just like, oh, this is just kind of a pop song. And then going back and listening again and realizing like, no, this is actually really a dark,
yeah,
like there's a real story and a fucked up through line to this that recontextualized after Magnolia. It was like, oh my God, there's so much, I just missed the brilliance when I was young, because I just thought it was just like a pop song.
Sure, sure. She's always been good at writing upbeat downers.
Yeah. You know,
right? Her album this year is one of my favorite albums of the year. Mental Illness. Have you heard it either?
No. I haven't heard it yet.
It might be like one of the best albums she's ever made in her life. It's incredible. I highly recommend it.
But it's funny, because I'm sure you think back to those times, like, oh my God, I haven't seen those people in a long time. And you're like, what, do you have like four kids now? Mm-hmm. You have four kids? And but I used to take Groundlings classes with your wife too.
You're kidding.
No, in like 96 maybe, I think like mid-90s.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. We were both there.
Was John Crane a teacher of yours?
I can't remember. It was, there was a woman named Karen Maruyama, and then there was a guy named Michael McDonald who was on. It was like... The Groundlings were either going to like SNL or Mad TV.
Yeah.
So it was just like a lot of those people. But yeah, it was great. I was really happy to. She was really super cool back then, and every time I would run into her, just still super cool. And
right.
Like now, like a mom with four kids, and still like, so I would imagine that takes a lot of your extra energy, though.
Absolutely. But there's no better place, or no other place I'd rather put it. But it's not even extra energy. The extra energy is left over for the movies now. The energy goes to them, honestly. Like, usually, like, Monday's my day off. Usually I, like, come into the editing room and, like, nap. Because you've just spent, like, 48 hours with four kids. And it's fun, but it takes a lot. A lot of energy. And I have a lot of energy, which is good. So I've got it to give. But yeah, it's great.
Did it change? Did having kids change? Because, you know, people say, oh my God, when I had kids, I realized it wasn't all about me anymore. And I just totally reprioritized, shifted all my priorities. And so were you ever concerned? Like, oh, am I still going to give a shit about making movies? Like, once I have kids, am I only ever going to care about that? Or do you still feel like your passions are...
I think I always knew that I would have a lot of kids. I've come from a big family, and I aspire to have many kids. I enjoy a big family. And I had no fear about it. Altering the landscape of my priorities or anything like that. I suppose in a practical way, I knew that I don't make movies that often. I mean, I make them every maybe sort of 2 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so being a writer is a really good job that fits in with being a father,
you know,
because if you choose to sort of work a kind of, you know, a schedule that allows for it. I wake up before the kids wake up, do some writing, and then get them up and get them to school. And then they're at school, you know, and then there's all that time that they're at school. So, but come 3 o'clock, you got to be ready. You got to be ready for the onslaught. So, but you do have to understand though, too, that when making a movie, that becomes very hard. That's about 3 months. That's about 60 days where you know, at this point, you have to look them in the eye, like, right, I'm not going to be around much, you know. But on this, they came over to England. You see them before you go to work, see them when you get home. So it all just flows. I mean, I don't know. I never had any fears of that.
But also, you I would imagine you have to learn. Were you a really disciplined? I assume you were a disciplined writer because you've been making movies for so long. But were you really good about going, okay, I need to write from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. or did that sort of change how you became your work with the creative time?
No, I was always kind of like that. Even as a kid, it was a really strange discipline that I had for myself. I think I worked really hard at it because I never felt like secure as a writer. So I really I put my mind to it at the exclusion of my schoolwork. I did not do schoolwork. I just practiced writing screenplays.
And now you're very successful. So the lesson here is don't do your schoolwork, kids. Oh, yeah. If your kids hear that, they're going to be like, you didn't do your school. I know I didn't, but you'd have to.
Yeah, I know. But look, if they were sitting down to write scripts, I wouldn't have a leg to stand on. Like, okay. I always had a good discipline. I think because I probably felt scared. Like, if you want to be a writer, there was always that thing of like, you know, that romantic thing of writers getting drunk and smoking cigarettes and writing. I learned pretty fast, like, that was kind of bullshit. At least it was for me. Like, right, if you get drunk, you can't write anything, right? Or at least it's not going to be any good. And somehow I kind of had this, maybe it was an insecurity thing. You're like, right, if I am a writer, that means I'm making my own, I'm kind of in charge of my day. I think I felt too horrified to kind of squander it. And not that I would sit down and write straight from 9 to 3. I mean, I consider writing like, even if from 9 to 3 I sit at my desk, or even if I sit on the couch and I watch TV, or even if I'm researching something, I know the amount of things that have to come out of me, even if they can come out quite fast.
Sure.
They can come out like in 45 minutes or an hour, but there has to be that room to sort of sit with something.
Yeah.
Or as long as you're... The old phrase, I've used it before, but I think Neil Young says, like, the muse will find you as long as you're sitting at your desk, you know? And I know what that means. That means, like, right, you can't, you know, you can't just go fuck off and with your day.
You can't be really running around town and doing stuff and, like, hanging out thinking that you're going to get hit with something that is worthwhile.
That in my experience, but I'm paranoid, you know? I feel like I got to work really hard.
I mean, I always love hearing how different writers – tackle this idea, but you know, when you sit down and it's like, oh, the screen's blank, I don't have it today, I can't get there, like, are you able to force yourself to write, or do you in those moments you go, all right, I'm not going to get anything done today, so I'm just going to put this away and I'll come back to it tomorrow?
Never try to face a situation like that. You go to that computer when you know you've got something to get out. And if you don't have anything that's ready to leap out, you better be finding ways to start digging something up. And that could be, even if that means sitting down and watching a movie or reading a book, or even if that means taking a walk or daydreaming, you know.
Yeah.
But getting in that spot where you like put that pressure on yourself, that's a head fuck. That'll ruin your confidence so fast. Like, right, I gotta come up with something good. I don't know. It's hard to be loose with writing, but I think I found that when I'm loose, it happens well. But other times, usually the stuff that you don't want to do is like editing or kind of, you know, the grudge work of it.
Right.
Which is just no fun. It's kind of like, well, the inspiration part already happened. Now I've got to find a way to make this readable and cut it down to a reasonable size, something like that.
And
does
do
that
it
make any sense?
In an amount of time like that's quick enough to where you don't get sick of the idea or bored of the idea.
For sure. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. You can labor on things for too long and then it all looks terrible. And then you really lose confidence.
You don't even know what the words don't mean anything anymore. Like, I've heard this scene so many times, I don't even know if it looks good anymore.
For sure.
It makes sense.
For sure.
Are there moments, you know, you must have like happy accidents
You know, where you're, oh, I actually meant to do this, but then this was such a happy accident. Now it's this. Can you think of any specific examples for any of your films, like anything kind of iconic where you're like, oh, that was a total accident there. We just accidentally, I didn't realize we had that. And then there it was.
You're putting me on the spot because I can't think of an example, but I know they happen all the time and they happen in a way. Just thinking about Daniel, actually, Daniel loves the typos and stuff that I leave in. And sometimes I'll leave them in. A typo or a kind of a repetition of something will happen that wasn't intended. Just when you're writing so fast, it just kind of comes out. And sometimes you stop and you look at it and you go, I'll just leave that in. And Daniel always picks up on them. He's like, oh, I love that. I was like, yeah, it was an accident. He's like, oh, we're gonna get. And he's always on the lookout for my typos to try to find a different way to flip words around or something like that. So I'm really aware of them and when they happen. I'm trying desperately to think of one to give you a good example, and I'm drawing.
But if you happen to think of one later, you can shout it out.
They didn't expect oil to come out of the ground. Well, no. Yeah, that was like, and they just like, you guys just kept rolling.
Earth improv.
Yeah. And then you were just like, let's roll with this oil.
This totally changes everything we were doing. But you know, with so is he retiring after this? Is like, this is it? He's taken a. That's it?
Yeah.
I can understand, based on the limited amount of information I have on him as a performer, my guess would be like, it seems like he gets just so engrossed in everything that at a certain point you're probably like, I would like to just live my life now and not have to go through that anymore. Is that part of it?
It seems to me that is a part of it for sure. I mean, I don't know. I would hope that he'll reconsider and maybe just the sort of going through the couple of years of work to do this took a toll. And he just wants to pause. But on the other hand, I could see that this is a real thing. He's just like, right, I want to do something else. I've got, you know, I suppose I don't know how much better he can do.
Right. Yeah. Whatever it is, he's done it. Yeah. Like, he's proved.
Yeah.
He's proved that he can do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, is that not – it's funny to hear you on the one hand say, oh, you get really paranoid and you get really stressed about output and get – but then do you not get neurotic about like, okay, this is Daniel Day-Lewis's last movie. This – got to make this good. You know, like, I mean, do you put that pressure on yourself, or are you able to just throw that to the side?
That's to the side. I mean, it was never – his decision not to retire came after the film – mercifully anyway, so perhaps I would have some pressure, but I mean you know, whatever nervous energy you bring into the beginning of a film goes away so fast with the practicalities of moving 40 people from one end of the street to the other, and just the nuts, the kind of shit nuts and bolts of it.
Right.
It just takes the wind out of you so fast. You're like, right, okay, all that horseshit kind of nerves, that's over. Right. Yeah. How do we need to get on with this.
I mean,
it just some real like practical marching thing takes over in you as a director. You like, there's no daydreaming. There's no nerves. There's no, none of that. Crap. Like, right, get on with it. There's a lot riding on this. There's a lot of people, you know, there's weather issues, there's budget issues, there's all that kind of stuff. You're like, come on, march on.
Yeah. Be whimsy on your own time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But you know, just hearing like, well, he's such a method guy and he's in he's super in character all the time. But obviously you figured out a way to communicate with him. But is that happening while you're shooting, or is that all done before? You're like, okay, we'll figure this out before. Then when we get on set, I will give you your space to be, you know, immersed.
Well, the idea of him being in character is true and it's accurate to a point, but it's not as if he doesn't realize he's in a film.
Sure.
He's making that, right. You know, that there's a camera right there.
And, sure.
You know, he understands what the mission is. But the majority of work, the times that I've worked with him, I think this is true for other directors too. I'm not really sure. It happens beforehand, like deep beforehand. So whether it's historical research that you're doing or just dialogue or just sort of working on the script and really sort of mapping it all out and really, really considering this is a man who lives here, and this is the tablecloth he's going to have, and those lamps, and all these sorts of details happen beforehand. And what's great about that is that when you do get to the set, there's very little dialogue about what we're going to do that day. There's you leave some decisions like hat on, hat off, tie, which color, you know, you leave some of those decisions because it's nice to leave something to do. You know, he still has to get out there and now do the scenes and stuff like that. But there's very little, discussion about what we're going to do once we're doing it. We're not improvising and kind of discovering things
right.
as we yeah. go too much. Yeah.
How did you pitch this movie to him? Did you have the script done or did you just have the idea for the pitch?
I had an idea and we had a desire to work together again. And I thought it would be nice to see him as a romantic kind of leading man. And now the stories took a lot of different turns along the way there. It's not exactly that. Yeah. But that was a kind of a start. Wanting to make a movie about a relationship that really focused on that and having him involved in that was like just one of the like the couple things that you kind of have on a piece of paper. Like, right, this, there's something here that could be really nice. And so we talked about ideas about we had a character that was kind of strong-willed and self-contained and self-possessed and cranky and, you know, that was artistic by nature so that it would be – the idea was about need, was about what happens when somebody like that finds themselves in a position where they find that they're really in love and that they need that love and that kind of idea. So really we had an idea. It could have been anything. It could have been a sculptor. It could have been a writer. It could have been a painter. Could have been a musician, something that kind of lends itself toward that kind of lifestyle.
Right.
But none of those seemed very interesting or had been done or weren't very cinematic. I mean, you know, rarely is like writing cinematic. You know, there's been some great movies, but it's not – seeing somebody sit at a typewriter, Lost Weekend's a great one. But anyway, there are good ones. But the idea of setting it in the world of fashion seemed really appealing to us. Dan's got a great love of clothes. And as a backdrop for this story that could get a little nasty and peculiar, it seemed really delicious to us having these women come in and out of this house and all these gorgeous gowns and the intricacies of what it means to make them. That was like, it was really floating our boat when we were reading about this stuff and getting into it.
I love the exploration of, you know, it's like being in a relationship, but like he's like, his business is women. He's surrounded by women
yeah.
all the time.
Yeah.
And beautiful women coming from all over the world.
Yeah.
It's like, and that can cause, you know, friction in like in a relationship, no matter what the, you know, intentions are. And,
right.
For eating. And I thought that was like that when that started kind of bubbling up, I thought was such a great way to.
But also talk just about the idea that, just the idea that I personally really, and this isn't too much of a spoiler, but just personally identifying with the kind of obsessive nature of his rituals.
Yeah.
And just the idea of like, this, you can't upset the ritual. Like, this is the ritual, and who are you to come in and fuck around with this? Oh, a second ago we were. We had sex, like I thought everything was great, but this is this time now,
yeah. right?
And this yeah. is my, and even sort of, you know, there is kind of a recurring maternal thing that happens with him, especially with Cyril,
mm-hmm.
And then mm-hmm. ultimately with Alma, I think it mm-hmm. sort of feels like that, but I think, you know, what I've noticed in a few of your films, this sort of idea of like, you know, these kind of flawed people who sort of figure out how to form a, you know, like they sort of choose to form their own family in a mm-hmm. way where it's like, this is the, we kind of pull together and we're this family, particularly with the Boogie Nights or, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, oh, they're forming a family. And I saw this with this a little bit too. Is that something that you think of or do you discover stuff about yourself after you see your movies and go, oh, I think I was trying to express this.
Yeah, probably. Well, that stuff, I mean, I don't know that you discover that after the movie's finished. You usually discover that, for me, kind of as the writing's going on. And then there are even more discoveries as you're filming it. Like, you're sitting there staring at two people in a scene, and you're like, that's not how I thought this was going to go at all. But it's welcome, and it's kind of exciting. that thing, it's funny, you talk about Boogie Nights, but that, I don't know anything about your life, but how intertwined is the life that you leave, let's say a personal life, and your work life? I would imagine they do intermingle, you know?
Absolutely.
And probably more and more these days, but certainly my experience in the movie business with the people that I work with, I'm so close to, you know, they, even when we're not making a movie, they're my friends. They're my an extension of my family. So I've always had that because I've since a very young age made films. So it's kind of, that's my life experience, full stop. Just like, right, I have a very blurry line between a family that I work with and a family that I actually live with.
Right. But you definitely, I'm curious to sort of understand how you're able, because you've worked with so many amazing actors, and, you know, not to discount them as human beings, but just there's something to it where it's like, oh, it's like the guy who can get into a with a bear cage or like a lion den and still, you know, like oh, he's going to be okay. Because, you know, these people that you work with, they can do a lot of things and they choose to work with you, but you obviously understand how to communicate with a lot of different personality types. And so, you know, is there some type of, you know, is that just,
I like that.
Did you have to learn how to do that? Or did you, or were you always like a good communicator? Cause not only do you have to be able to just communicate with them person to person, but you also kind of have to get them to sort of do what you need them to do, which is another hurdle.
Yeah, did that come from being from a big family?
I wonder. I never thought of it quite like that. That's an interesting. I mean, but that may create a false impression, that sort of idea of getting them to do what you need them to do.
Okay.
I never totally felt like that. I always feel like that there's always an agreement of what we're after, and that if there's a help that I could give as a director, is that if I happen to spot something that you're not getting there, the thing that we've agreed on, that this is going to be funny, and let's say it's not funny, like, well, it's not funny. So now how do we make it funny? You know, and so never really feel like that sense of I've got to navigate somebody towards something that I need them to do. I've heard of things like that, like directors, like with kind of Machiavellian plans, like I'm gonna pit you against you, and then I'm gonna tell you one thing.
Oh, right, right, right.
I'm gonna tell you something else.
Yeah.
And that, I don't know, that's fucking scary to me. That would backfire.
That seems like it could super backfire.
Sooner or later, you guys are going to get in the same room and be like, he told me that the secret history was that we were brothers. He's like, no, and whatever it was. So I think the actors that I were, everybody likes to be on the same page. Like, right, what are we after? What's the mission? And as a director, in that part, you're just trying to have a wide angle view just to make sure maybe somebody's forcing it to, you know, it's like you can, you know, I'm sure you've sort of seen that, like Groundling stuff, just like, so how helpful is it? Somebody on the outside is just like, you're pushing it, you're forcing it, just
right,
whatever those kind of words can be. And more than words, it's like just the setup of a situation, like, you know. I haven't seen many other sets, but sometimes you sort of get a sense that they're not really set up for the actor, that the actor might as well just be like the tablecloth.
Right.
You know, and that's not at all how I like to work or the people so it's more like everything we're doing is in service of the actor. I think I learned that early on with like the movies that I like. I have these great performances in it. That was the stuff that was really speaking to me. But two, the other thing is you realize like, right, I remember like a few months before my first movie, I was like, what do I remember from looking at movies? I remember looking at the actors. Like I don't really remember what the wall color was. I don't remember production design. I just remember looking at the actors. That's always been the thing I've been like, that's the biggest thing in the frame usually when you go see a movie, right? You know, I mean, yeah, you can maybe get some wide shots of a desert. The desert looks good, but how long can you do that? That would get really boring really fast. You absolutely look at this waterfall. Oh, it's a fucking great waterfall. Look at this river. Great River. But sooner or later, that you know that would be a travel log film, you know?
Right?
You after that shot, you really need to cut to an actor's face who's going to tell me the story that I'm there to see.
It's so enlightening to hear you say that, because now that you're saying that, it's like when I'm thinking about all your movies, I'm going, oh yeah, oh I see it. That you do form a relationship with your performers, but you as a director are there to serve them and not yourself. And it makes all the sense in the world why so many great actors want to work with you, because even if they can't articulate that, they feel it.
Sure.
They see it on screen, you know, because everyone, I mean, look, an actor really has to trust a director, because whatever they do on set, you know, even if they give the most brilliant performance in the world, there's not 100% guarantee you're going to use that take, or that you're going to edit it that way, or that they're going to look great.
That's exactly right. And you know as many actors as I do. Yeah, there's an unfortunate thing that can get in because of situations like that, that unfortunately a lot of actors just fighting for survival will have to listen to a director nod their head who's saying a bunch of fucking horseshit to them. And they're like, yes, yes, yes. And they're like, right, let me just go do what I need to do.
Right.
You know, and that happens, unfortunately. Like, so I don't know the way around that, because actors have to survive and they have to take care of themselves too. But I think, yeah, if they feel safe and they feel comfortable, that's when they're at their best, you know?
Do you involve them at all in the editing process? Are you like, hey, what do you think of this or this? Or like once they're done with their performance, they're like, okay, now I'll get it from here.
I do invite them to be involved in that. And some of them don't want to be involved. And some of them do. You know, Joaquin, you have to like drag him by the hair of his head to get him in. And then he'll kind of look at it like this, like, you know.
With his head down, yeah.
With his head down. But also in the meantime, I can remember getting a few kind of really good ideas from him. Just he's like, well, do you think we need that or whatever it is? There's a certain amount of work it's really good for a director to do on his own when
sure.
editing a movie together. But I always love including the actors.
That's very brave too, because you, in the sense that, you know, you might love a take of something and an actor goes, my chin looks weird in that. And you're like, yeah but I need the, no, but everything else is.
Yeah. Vanity will be the first thing that they'll. Yeah.
Well, but just try not to hire those actors.
Don't hire fat actors. That's what Paul Thomas said.
No, but it, and that I think again goes back to the idea of just having a good relationship with them, and you know, that making the actor feel safe is probably a really good thing to do, because you're going to get the best performance out of them and they're going to want to work with you. Mm-hmm. And it's going to all click probably a lot better than if they feel like, if they're in their head or they feel threatened or they feel like not safe.
I mean, and even if you just took it to a practical level, like what could ruin everybody's day is like if an actor's not happy or they're not getting it right, like, you know, those sort of moments where somebody like can't remember their line or they're feeling tight or whatever it is, like you're not going anywhere until you get it, you know? So like, right. Yeah. They're the most important thing. The idea that is like the movie goes to the actor, not this actor has to come to this movie.
Right. You know?
But that said, that's sort of around whoever the lead of the story is. And I think there's other things like you ask people to come in for a day's work or even a couple hours work. Do you know what I mean? They're expected to step into a movie that is already existing and a world that's already on fire, and you have to kind of, well, you know what I mean,
right? Yeah.
And that has, you have to be very careful with that too, because I you know, that can be very intimidating for people, like,
right?
Like, what movie are we in? Because I mean, do you want me to, am I funny in this? But hopefully you have those conversations way in advance and you figure that out, so that those poor people have to come in very quickly can, you know, have something to offer and don't feel just like tourists.
Yeah.
Well, like when Martin Short came in Inherent Vice, it's like it became like very like a Martin Short scene.
Which, yeah, was
great. I love that scene.
Yeah, I would never worry about Martin Short being nervous though.
Yeah, that's true.
But like, he's such a chill dude. He's just such a chill guy. Like, it really is remarkable that as a comedy entity, he's probably the least insecure comedy person I've ever met.
Yeah.
Because he you see him on stage and he's still as funny as he ever was. And I saw him and Steve Martin at do their live show.
Where did you see it?
I went to Vegas to see it.
So did I.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
I was
in like July or August?
I went in early November. They did it in the fall. I don't know if it was November, but it was in the fall. They did it again in the fall.
Okay.
You know, I went, I took my mom with me and I took Will and we just went and they were great. And, you know, with comedy in general and actors too, it's really trying to like, there's a real art to trying to at least disguise the neediness or push it out of the way of like, I need people to like me. And he doesn't have any of that. Like, there's just none of it.
Yeah.
It's like he could be sitting here talking with us and then just walk up and start doing a performance and then sit back down and keep talking. Like, he was super cool afterwards. Like, there was no – it just didn't seem to be in his head at all about that stuff.
I think he's I would venture to guess he's always kind of been like that. And maybe I'm wrong because I've only known him these past 5 or 6 years, gotten to know him. And I agree with you completely. He's pretty secure in his own skin. Then again, I mean, if I was that fucking funny.
Yeah,
I
I know. But I know people who are super fucking funny and basket cases.
And that absolutely. That's absolutely right. That find it really hard to put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah, where I kind of go like, I don't know if I would want to be that funny if it meant I had to be that like spinning, have my brain spin that hard all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
Marty's more, I think, cut from another era. And I kind of, you know, I don't know how much fun those vaudeville guys were to be around, but I don't know, maybe less insecure than another newer generation of comedians, but Marty seems just so at ease with everything. He's like, what do you want me to do? I'll do this movie. I'll do the opening of that can. What do you want to do? Let's go. I don't really give a fuck. He's really just like, I don't give a fuck. Let's put on a show, you know, which is so – that's what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just loose. It's like, right.
But you can't engineer that kind of don't give a fuck. You really just have to – and it's not – I mean, he cares about what he does, but I mean, it's just that – yeah, it is. I think it's like – it's just a lack of – you know, when people – people, I think magnetism, there's a part of magnetism that I think is someone who doesn't need you or need anything. You're just kind of drawn to them. I don't know. It's like, oh, what's the – how do they know this weird secret? You know, like they're just so – they can take you or leave you. And not that they're not nice, but I just mean there's not like that desperation at the core of all of it.
Well, desperate – yeah. Desperate in our performers is not what we want, is it?
Right.
Yeah.
What is the – I just saw it on IMDb and I didn't know it. What was the Dirk Diggler short film that you did in 88?
That was it. That was the boogie, basically Boogie Nights as when I was 17 and obsessed by like the – which the now way overdone and overused format of fictional documentary, you know, but Zelig and Spinal Tap.
Right.
Were the things that I loved. And I had the story of like doing it around kind of like the Axl Rose thing. We're talking about like a hick who comes to town who turns into a porno star. And I had Dirk Diggler and Jack Horner and Amber Waves and all these characters. And so I did it as a fictional documentary when I was 17 years old. I was a senior in high school. And I filmed it with just friends that I had, friends of mine, friends of my dad's. And that's what that is. And that the bones of the story are Boogie Nights. They're this essentially the same, you know, it's a rise and fall. He comes, he rises, he got a big dick, he rises to the top, then he kind of crashes. And then I think in the film, he meets a tragic end overdosing. But, and it was, but then, and so that was whenever that was, 1987. And so then over the years, I just continued to write and write and write and write it out and wrote it as a, you know, as a fictional story. Which was a really interesting way to do it, actually. I felt like I was adapting a documentary that somehow really existed. Sort of like it went on for so long that I'd actually tricked myself into thinking
these are real people.
These are real people, and I'm just adapting the life story from this documentary that exists. But it was like, well, you made it and came up with it. It was really kind of a bizarre way to work. But
that idea, and I think, you know, that spawned a whole, I mean, like that, I think – created this whole thing of like, oh, let's play with porn, like porn as a real genre, like a mainstreamy kind of a genre. But you know, again, I don't think like that was an example of like of almost a science experiment of can you humanize, you know, mm-hmm. can you for an audience humanize something that when people, you know, watch porn or consume porn, the last thing they're thinking of is like, what are their backstories of these actors? You know, yeah. It's like, what did they do before they got there? You know, like really making people like the sex part is just completely incidental.
Yeah.
It's really just about these human characters. They just happen to be working in this field, but really it's just about.
No, the things like that had dealt maybe with porno before maybe had always had like, it was like super, super dark, you know, right. Like if you're in porno, you know, it means you're from the Midwest and your father and you were like raised like Christian and you came to LA and you were sort of thrust into prostitution and it's just fucking misery. And it's like hardcore. It's like Paul Schrader's right. film hardcore. So there was always kind of a treatment about pornography that was kind of like that, or it was just super fucking wacky and ridiculous and like yeah. you just come up like laughing at the crazy porn titles and stuff mm-hmm. they had. So maybe we just happened to be there a spot. I think that speak for yourself, because I would always get the feeling like looking at porno as like a kid, you're like, wait a minute, how does this work exactly? Like did they drive there? So they drove to this house, right? And do they know each other? Like
did that guy have a boner going to thing, or did he just get it right then?
Exactly.
Yeah. And what is the
all of that? I mean, I couldn't help but ask those questions. I was dying to know the answers to those questions.
But I think it's, you know, to think about doing that when you were a senior in high school and making a film in 1987 when it was not easy to make a film in 1987. We shot it on video. You shot on video. So did you do VCR to VCR editing?
That's exactly right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The classic.
Yeah. Just a little snow between cuts.
Just a little wavy. Yeah. Like.
Well, the good thing about that was that your film would only get shorter. It would never get longer because you realize like, oh shit. Okay, let me try that again. And so that was helpful to keep the running time down. Yeah. And then I tried to buy a video editing deck or rent one, and I just couldn't even get through the manual. I was so inept at reading it. I was like, I'm just going to stick with VCR to VCR. Yeah. Yeah.
And was it for a school project or just because you wanted to
do
it?
No, it was just because I wanted to do it.
Oh, that's incredible. I mean, it's not often that when someone is 17 years old, they go, I know exactly what it is that I want to do. And I'm just, and now I feel like we take it for granted because, you know, if I'm 17 now and I want to make films, like people fucking make films all day because they have a studio in their fucking pocket.
Right, right.
But, you know, just the idea of, and where did you grow up?
In Studio City.
Oh, you grew up in Studio City.
Yeah.
Home of studios.
Yeah.
So you.
But it was the first time I was like, I mean, I had the ambition to do it and I felt really confident because I could do it in my backyard. I had the right people to fill these parts. This great actor named Bob Ridgely, who's a friend of my dad's, who ended up being in Boogie Nights, plays the Colonel in Boogie Nights. He would play the Jack Horner role. And the only thing I had my camera and it was just this logistical thing, like, right, how am I going to pull this off? Okay, what do I need? This is easy because I can do this in my backyard. I've got these guys running down the wash. I can do that. And just the kind of the logistical practice and learning that went into that was everything. What do I need that I don't have? I need a motel room. I have to have a motel room. So we're riding my bike up. It's not there anymore. They tore it down and built a new one. The Universal City Motel right by Lancashire and Ventura. Uh-huh. I was like, how much is a room? I think it was $100. I was like, okay, can I pay you cash? Can I pay you check? And I think it was cash. And so I had $100 and I was like, how far in advance do I need to tell you that I'm going to be here? You know? And I think they were like, you think they were looking at me like, and I was 17. So then I had to go. Then the next step is like, right. What day can I get everybody together? Because that's really the thing. That's still the thing, making a movie.
Yeah,
that's
a schedule.
That is still the thing. Like, we can't have her on that day. She's got another movie, or she's out of town, or she's with her family. I mean, it just did not get any easier. So I was learning it really fast. I was like calling, all right, so I have a cast of 10. I'm going to make 10 phone calls. On Tuesday, December 6th, can you, at 7 o'clock, can you be at the Universal? And finally found that date that worked for everyone. Which was a school night.
Of course.
Like, tried, of course, for the weekends. Or I think maybe if we shot on a school, I think rates were lower as well for the motel, so I could keep the budget down as well. So that was another factor. And got everybody to this motel and shot what I needed to shoot from about 6 or 7 o'clock until about midnight. And then the rest was sort of easy to fill in the blanks and all that kind of stuff, because I would only need one or two characters here and there. Fond memories of that. That was the first, like, single-handedly, like, right, putting this together. It was a great feeling to do it.
Is it available anywhere? Is it online? Did you put that on? Is that online, or is that on, like, a DVD box set of something?
It's not. It probably should be. I fear that what's out there, it's the days of VHS. It's so mangled and so fucked up and hard to watch. I have a copy. I need to probably see what I can do about preserving it better.
Oh, you really should. Did you not transfer it to digital? Still on a tape?
No, it's still on a tape.
Oh, you gotta get that.
Yeah. Somebody sold it online. I saw you can buy it online, or it's out there. It may be on YouTube. I actually haven't looked. I'm sure it's got to be on YouTube.
Katie, look it up. See if it's on YouTube.
I would imagine.
Did you say the name was?
It was
Dirk Diggler story.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's got to be. It's not often the internet fails you 100%.
No.
Where
not like some content.
Is it on there?
It's loading.
Okay.
We'll wait.
Sorry. I wonder how long it is. It's not 30 minutes. It's between 20 and 30 minutes. That's absolutely it.
Holy shit. There it is.
How are we doing? How many views does it
have? Are they playing ads on it? I'm going to need some of that.
Yeah. But don't go to the comments section. That could really ruin your day.
That's
yeah,
a general. That's a good down. Rule in general.
Down.
To never go to the comments section. That's fantastic. So that's just like on YouTube. The Dirk Diggler story is actually just on YouTube. You can just watch
you
it. So
can
it
find
is.
It
is. How does something like that get out if you have a copy of it?
No, there would be copy. I mean, that was something that I sent around. Like,
oh, look, you sent
Hollywood.
It
I'm here. Yeah. Like 17 years old. Like,
so you want to make porn?
No, exactly. Boxing it up, like. Shazam, look.
Do you this might be a stupid question, so I apologize, but when you look back at all of your work, do you see it as chapters of the same story, or do you see each one as kind of its own organism?
I guess more towards that thing you just said, like each or like you, I really look at them related personally to like, oh, I used to live right around the corner here and driving up. You're like, oh, right, I lived here when I made Magnolia. So I tie them so closely to chapters of my life. What was going on? Oh, right. Oh, that was the year my dad died. Oh, that was my year my sister got sick, whatever it was, all that kind of stuff. They're tied like that to my experience,
yeah,
you know, like deeply.
And do you kind of look at them as like diaries in a way, like, because they're obviously stories going on that the audience wouldn't know, but in your head it's really, it's almost like a playlist in a way.
Sure. I would say that for sure. Yeah, it would be hard to look at something outside of it being that, like, oh, that was just that one-off that I you know, that would be weird. No. Yeah. They're all like these extensions of, you know, what's going on? Like, you know, how you're feeling. Some are probably happier than others or crankier than others. But that's not to say, I mean, There Will Be Blood is like one of the happiest times of my life. And that's a pretty dark film as well. So it's not as if there's a correlation in that way.
Right.
You know? Yeah, it's funny like that. Yeah, I mean, that was a really magical time. My first daughter had just been born. Life was like really great. Like, nobody was sick. Everything was firing on all cylinders. And yet, film is fucking nasty. But that's okay, you know, because that was the film, that was the thing we were setting out to make, you know.
Right.
That was, yeah, whatever that was. I guess on the maybe that at that time the world was a little upside down. Personally, my life was great, but the world, that was that kind of, those that George Bushy time and all that kind, yeah, of stuff. So I don't know, there might have been some of that, but.
Do you ever say like, oh, you know, I think I want to try to make a Western, like, you know, when you're making There Will Be Blood, you go, I want to try to make a Western, or do you come up with the story and then go, oh, this is kind of what it needs to be? I mean, do you actively seek to do something different every time, or is it just like, well, whatever this is, it just is?
Try to, yeah, but within reason, not like, right, we really got to make a musical, guys, you know, that kind of thing. Like that, not that broad reaching. It's more like, I think you do have aims towards something. Like on this, it was, there were these films that I loved, and the idea of one, the smallest idea was writing a relationship movie about a man and a woman, right? Okay, but that, so that could be any number of scenarios. Thinking about Daniel, thinking about those gothic romance movies that I love, the Rebeccas and all that kind of, the Gaslights and stuff like that, that kind of starts to guide you towards a little bit of a genre, you know, that kind of helps you have a foothold, like, right. It wasn't as if I said, like, you know, I believe me, I have an itch to sort of, you haven't always have an itch to kind of go out to Barbados to start shooting or something, mm-hmm, like that, but don't really listen to it too strongly. Some, like, it's just the things that start accumulating. They're like, this is good. This is exciting. This sounds good. I like that idea. Come on, going to London. This is good. This is getting good. This is getting good. You know, you just keep hope, like, accumulate exciting ideas that days later are still exciting. You know, when you find, like, it hasn't worn off. There's no, I'm not just drunk. I'm not hung over with this. This is like, it has staying power. It gets you excited. And then the next thing you know, for me at least, you're like, it's too late. You're going. That's
great. We're living there now. It's happening. Yeah. So you follow the emotion in the gut more than the conscious, like, I am going to do this.
I think so, yeah. But then you start, you know, that gut stuff only lasts for so long. And then you start getting practical. You're like, well, this is what's happening. This is this film. And how does that shape look and all that? Yeah.
It is a relationship, though, because you can get so excited about an idea, and then when you're doing it, it's like, oh, I have to stay, you know, you have to stay excited about this, because right, it's like a relationship. I mean, it really is a relationship.
Yeah.
Someone was saying that, they said, oh, have you seen the Meyerowitz
stories?
Yeah. Stories? And I go, no, I haven't seen. They go, Adam Sandler's amazing in it. And they sort of said it like, can you believe Adam Sandler? I was like, but he's great in Punch Drunk Love. You know, it's like, yeah, he's great in Punch Drunk Love. And then I know, but, you know, obviously he does this, he does the Adam Sandler character in, you know, yeah, like now on Netflix. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think you really help show the world, like, oh, like, he's a real actor. Like, he really is a performer.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I mean, I think that there should be, like, a moratorium on the, like, Adam Sandler's a real actor articles that I kind of see. I'm like, come on. It's so, it, like, becomes like he's fucking, you know, I've always loved Adam. And he's giving, like, great performance after great performance. Like, not even, I haven't seen Meyerowitz stories yet. But remember, like, Funny People came out.
Yeah.
It was that same thing. Yeah, yeah. It was like, Funny People. Wait, yeah, till you see how good Adam Sandler is. You're like, right. Like, it wasn't the last movie that he was, you know. And,
yeah,
and it's funny. It's like some people, I don't know, that they get in a position where somehow audiences still feel like they need to be proven somehow.
Well, I just think, so I think for some people, because a lot of people don't look – and again, this just goes back to people maybe not having enough attention or just being dicks. I don't know. But not really looking at a full scope of someone's work or someone's story. They see a couple things or a handful of things. You know, he's sort of done the Adam Sandler character in more movies than he has not.
That's true.
And so I think for a lot of people, they just go, oh, he's just a goofy, like, blah, 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 blah.
He didn't switch it up as much as Robin Williams did early on.
Right.
Which is to, like, kind of...
Right. And so I think that's probably... You know, and most people really will form a judgment based on one or two things.
I wonder, I mean, I was there for Peter Sellers doing Being There when that came out. And I remember that was really like, Peter Sellers doing a dramatic part, you know, but it's not that fucking dramatic. It's still fucking hilarious. But there is a thing I think is particularly attached to comedians, that if we've gotten to know them through them making us laugh, and suddenly we're sort of on edge for anything else that might happen. Robin Williams is a really good example. You remember there was sort of like, Robin Williams in Good Morning Vietnam was a big
part. I think going back to Moscow on the Hudson, where it was like, it's not really a cop. Like, he did some Robin Williamsy things in it.
He was big. It was a big character because he was a big Russian, you know.
Right. But ultimately, it was like a really kind of a, it was a serious, it's kind of a serious, kind of a
Tom Hanks is somebody who has successfully confused audiences. And I mean that as a grand compliment.
Right.
And that we expect a lot from him because he's so fucking good.
Yep.
He's hilarious. And when he started out, it was Bachelor Party.
Bachelor
and
Party.
Turner and Hooch and Splash.
Burbs.
But
Splash was the first one.
Splash was first.
And he, and that was like, and that's when he sort of said, I'd heard this, I worked with a TV director once who had done Bosom Buddies. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, right out of the gate, Splash did really well. And Tom had this theory that if you do a movie and it's successful, you get three more chances. And if any one of those are successful, you get three more chances. And so he does have a few kind of early on where that are.
He made a lot of great films though too. Like, so I'm trying to think of the order in my head and I'll get it wrong. But basically Big was the thing that was like something besides just wacky, you know, and, but he's hilarious in it as well, you know. And then another level was when you saw him in League of Their Own. Remember?
Right.
Yeah. That was and still is. I don't know if you've seen that performance lately, but fuck, it's so good.
It's great. Yeah. And then Philadelphia.
And then you get
Gump,
to the more, you know, the D, you know, capital D dramatic stuff, Philadelphia. But I don't know. How do we get on this? Tom Hanks.
Well, we're talking about comedians. And you know, like how there's some prejudice in the business against comedians, which I personally think, you know, I get irritated that the Oscars is so snubby about comedies when I think comedies, I think it, like if they go toe to toe, I think a really solid comedy is equally, if not harder to make in some senses than drama, because you really are having to go out on a limb to make people relate to it and laugh. And that's a very hard thing to do. And a lot of comedians, I feel like, because they're so complicated, can give insane dramatic performances because they are, a lot of them are very serious people.
Yeah, I mean, I dare anybody to try and do what Tiffany Haddish did in that movie. I mean, right? You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know Tiffany really well. You're talking about Girls Trip.
Yeah. That's like a fucking magic trick how good she is in that. And I dare anybody to try and go on like take after take or even do one take as good as she is. She is a fucking force.
She's
such a great performance.
I remember seeing her in the back of the improv, in the small room at the in the improv a few years ago. And she was crushing in front of a really small crowd. And I was like, she's going to be a superstar. You could just see it. Like whatever it was, the perfect combination of drive and funny and charisma.
She's very honest, too, the way she... that's some of her stand-up stuff that I've heard. I haven't heard much of it, but it's pretty fucking straightforward.
We did we did this thing for Comedy Central called the Comedy Jam, where you... It was very similar to Greg Barrett's Bring the Rock.
Uh-huh.
Where you tell a story, and then you do a song about it. And we were on the same show, and she did the Tina Turner. And the fucking musical performance, her voice was incredible. Like, had the dress, like, nailed the song, nailed the dancing, nailed the performance. I was like, she's just one of those people that's just going to crush at every performance-related thing that she does. But do you...
How old do you think she is? I don't know, I'm never supposed to ask.
Tiffany, I mean,
age.
She's probably she's early 30s.
She's early 30s, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, late 20s, early... Probably early 30s.
Yeah,
I think so. But, I mean, I would imagine you see performers like that because obviously you love comedy and you just sort of file that away and go, I think that there's
absolutely
some,
for sure. Or not even file it away. Like, I'm inspired. Like, look, how can I be a part of that?
But you have a tremendous power because you can make people see a dimension of someone. Even like Burt Reynolds. Like, Burt Reynolds hadn't done really anything in a while that wasn't kind of goofy. And everyone's like, oh, my God. You know, it's like you you sort of, you don't just bring the humanity and complexity to the stories, but also the meta stories of the performers who are in them. People go, holy shit, look at, like, look well, at even that.
With Philip Seymour Hoffman in Magnolia, like, that was, like, the first time I saw him, like, do something that wasn't just, like, really sad and creepy. Like, you know, like, his role in Happiness.
That's
and
then, funny. That's right. That's yeah. right.
Like, he's so sweet.
Straight
in
kind of character. Yeah. 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 Well, I don't know. I mean, this just goes back to some things that we were talking about before. I think some of these things, you look at most films and how many times does somebody just like get to like sit and perform a scene or settle with something or like let the camera hold on them? That's not anything particularly fantastic that I'm doing except maybe allowing a little bit of breathing room. Like, you give somebody just a chance to settle with something. So many scenarios that you see in films are like there's, somebody's rushing somewhere. There's something going on that just is clouding an ability to like just to see what's going on. If you're it's too much rushing around or too much cutting, sometimes it's just like, well, I don't know where to look. That's why I think Tiffany Haddish could have been as good as she is in that movie, but it was really well directed and it was really actually really well put together. I mean, it's conceivable that she could have done that performance. And it might have been missed, like this thing we were talking about before, cut the wrong thing or not frame it the right way. But there's a lot of like just patient directing and letting those girls do their thing, not trying to spice it up, not trying to Shazam it all over the place. And I think that allows her to like fucking just give me the keys. Just put that over there and let me do my thing and don't get in the way.
So as we're sort of wrapping this up, I'm going to ask a question that I feel like now like you're on a panel. And I get up in front of the microphone. I go, hey, I have a question for you. But let's just say that there are two guys who are sitting in front of you who separately are both going to direct their first thing, first movie, sometime within the next year or two. Mm-hmm. What would you say to those guys? Like, what is it? Is there any like when you sort of distill it down and when you think about directing, what is it? What do you think your job is? And then also, like, what are some things that you like? Just you know, wisdom nuggets or things like mantras that you have, or just ways that you think about it.
Well, the first thing I would suggest is that you go get Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, great idea! Yeah. Well, I think he just retired though.
Because
I'm gonna get him out of retirement.
Because then you
do a horror movie.
Yeah. You will look like the greatest director. You know, whatever you're going to do, get good actors. And I mean, a lot of this conversation has been about that. Like, get those actors, talk to them early, get them involved, and get – because they're the ones and they're going to be the thing they're looking at. That's what I would – that's my one piece of free advice. Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, even about directing, this is my one other thing that I've found. I think I've said this before is like – trouble that I've had consistently 10 out of 10 times directing was always like when the writing was shit. Like you got a really good scene, you get there that day, suddenly you're like, it's falling together. I mean, yeah, it's work, but it generally falls together if it's well written, like, and you know it on the page. And those kind of like ones that you haven't dealt with that are sitting out there, or even something that you think is well written that ultimately you can't see the time is actually not even going to be in the movie.
Yeah.
Those are the days where your head's exploding and you're like biting your lip and you're like, I don't know what's going on. I can't figure it out. I've found that it's always about the writing. That's the only two things I can say, because it's not that hard to go to work each day when the writing's good. You're like, right, just keep it simple, keep it straight, make plays. Like, I remember telling guy I was working with at the time, like, you just drive him to work and he's like, he said the greatest thing to me was like, just make plays. It was like a basketball metaphor. It was like that thing you see when you're like, everybody's trying to do too much shit and you're there, like the coach is like, just make plays.
Right.
Like, that was good advice that he gave me sitting in the back of the car. Just make plays. I was like, great. That's a good one.
Excellent. So Phantom Thread, is the movie – this is going up the – oh, it's Christmas Day. Is it Christmas Day?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's coming out in the end of January for the rest of the country.
So why? So limited release Christmas and then wide release at the end of January.
Yes.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on. And,
thanks for having me in your home.
It's really nice to see you and go see the movie. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. Okay.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.